Technology. If you've listened to this podcast for more than a few episodes, you realize that's one of the underlying themes here. That I'm interested in technology, how it appears in popular culture, how it developed. It's what I've researched, written about, taught about, and I think about it a lot. I think about its promise and potential and what it can offer humanity. And if you had asked me on October 15th, 2023, how to self-describe myself, I might say I was a techno-optimist. But on October 16th, Mark Andreessen, the founder of Netscape, released the Techno-Optimist Manifesto, and I can no longer say that I'm a techno-optimist. I'll explain why in this episode of the ImplausiPod. When the manifesto was originally published, I gave it a quick scan, and that scan raised a number of red flags. And throughout the rest of this episode, we'll look at those red flags as if they were laid down by a surveyor on the landscape. But before we do, I want to go into the value of giving something a quick scan, of jotting down your initial impressions. I'm going to employ another surveyor's tool, one of triangulation, of being able to hone in on the target by looking at it from different angles and directions, from different points of view. Because, as we talked about a few episodes ago, that empathetic view of technology requires that triangulation, of being able to step outside of one's own perspective and view it from the perspective of somebody else. And this can be done for both things we find positive and things we find negative as well. So, as is tradition, we're going to talk about something by chasing down a couple of tangents first before we get back to those red flags. But bear with me, it'll all kind of come together at the end. So when it comes to the Techno-Optimist Manifesto, the thing that really struck me was the ability to identify those red flags, to spot them, to pull them out of the larger text. And it was a 5,200-word text, don't get me wrong, there was a lot going on in there. But I think identifying these red flags speaks to something larger, the ability of experts or people heavily involved in a field to identify key elements or themes and figure out where a problem may be lying. It doesn't matter which field it's in, whether it's a mechanic or a medical doctor, an academic or an art historian. And if that last one rings a bell, it's because there's a pretty well-known source for it. In his 2005 book, Blink, Malcolm Gladwell talked about the process by which an art historian was able to evaluate a statue that was brought into the Getty Museum. And at a glance, the evaluators were able to identify key features that led him to believe that the work in question was a forgery, that the statue in question had never actually been in the ground and subsequently recovered. So it's the ability to spot minutiae of a given artifact or piece of art, and through long experience and knowledge and exposure, be able to determine its authenticity, the validity of a piece of work. And again, this isn't just an academic thing. It goes across so many fields, crafts, trades, practices. It's a key, essential element of them. And to link it back to the ongoing discussion about AI, it's one of those things that AI-generated texts or artifacts often lack. It's that authenticity. We can sense that there's something off about the piece. As the saying goes, we can tell by the pixels. So this assemblage of tools that we have, the skills and knowledge and practice, experience, all come together to form what we call a set of heuristics. It's similar to what Kenneth Burke calls equipment for living. And there he's referring to like literature and proverbs, and they function in a similar way to like memes that we've talked about last episode. But these are the tools that we can use to judge something, how we can come to an assumption about what we're seeing in front of us. We do this for pretty much everything, but when it's something that's particular to our skill or our particular area, then we can make some judgments about it. And when it comes to those particular topics, perhaps we have a duty to communicate that information, to share that knowledge with the world around us. So that's what we're going to get into here with the techno-optimist discussion and the red flags. Because I've read a lot of the texts that Andreessen cites within the manifesto, but obviously I have a radically different worldview, and we can discuss why we might come up with those radically different interpretations at the end. But before we do, I want to throw out one more point into the mix, one more element or angle for our triangulation on the topic at hand, and something I like to call the forest hypothesis. Now, this is different than the dark forest hypothesis, where we are as a species tiny mice in a universe filled with predators lurking in the darkness, which we'll touch on next episode, I think. Rather, the forest hypothesis is related back to that Blink idea. that it's a way of evaluating knowledge, of evaluating expertise. The forest hypothesis basically asks, how much can you talk about on a given subject if you're out in the forest away from any cell phone signal, Wikipedia, handheld device, book, or any other form of external knowledge, something that was extrinsic to yourself? How long can you talk about it? And it's a good test. There are people who can expound endlessly on stuff that they know about, and there are those who may be less comfortable discussing things online or in an academic setting, but you know, when push comes to shove, they actually do know things, and they don't have to just reach out to their Wikipedia on their phone. Now, the analog to this is the bar talk phenomenon that we used to have, when no one had access to phones, and we'd get into discussions and arguments about who could recall what. We could call it like the Cliff-Clavin corollary, right? We're not necessarily sure in the moment, but we can use rhetorical strategies to ask, does this sound right to you, or are you like just making that up? And in the interest of full disclosure, much of the rest of this episode about the red flags came from two conversations that I had with different sets of colleagues about the Techno-Optimist Manifesto and the material espoused within. So much of the rest of this episode is going to be me recreating that discussion and talk off the top of the head as best I can. I'll refer back to specific elements, but without further ado, why I am not a techno-optimist. So as stated, the Techno-Optimist Manifesto was published on the morning of October 16th, 2023. During the day, it started making the rounds on social media, on Mastodon, and elsewhere, and I saw numerous links to it, so I thought I'd dive in and give it a quick look. There's been articles written about it since, in the intervening 10 days or so, but I wanted to really just capture my thoughts that I had at the time. I jotted them down and had them in conversations with colleagues, as stated. So, flipping through the manifesto, I gave it a kind of high-level skim, and a couple things started to pop out. And these were the red flags that started to be a cause for concern. The first of those was some of the works cited. Now, one of those heuristics that I mentioned earlier is that you can use whenever you're evaluating an article. It's kind of, you read it from the front, you read it from the back, and then you can read the meat of the article itself. It's like a sandwich. Which means you look at the abstract or the introduction, and then take a look at some of the authors they're citing, because if you're familiar with them, you can give an idea, or you can get an idea, of where the conversation is going to go. With respect to the manifesto itself, early on in the work, Mark Anderson starts referring to a number of economists who were influences for the work that he was producing. The first one he mentions is the work of Paul Collier, who wrote an influential book called The Bottom Billion, which talks about development in the global south. There's nothing really wrong there. He's going into some interesting information about what's happening in the developing economies around the world. But then Anderson goes on to cite Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman as influences. Now, from a glance, and these are, you know, well-known and respected economists, and Hayek in particular for his work on the knowledge problem, but both of them were influential in other ways, and they drove policy for the Thatcher governments in the UK in the 70s and 80s, as well as the Reagan governments in the US in the 1980s. So they had a very neoliberal bent to them, and a lot of the underlying ideology from their economic works are what we still see in policy circles today. Taking a look at the state of the world and the economic system, we may want to question some of those underlying influences, and seeing them mentioned in this manifesto is raising some red flags again. Now, even though some economists like, say, Tyler Cowen would recently include both Hayek and Friedman as part of their greats of all time, and I'm not disputing this, they have a massive influence, but those influences can have outsized effects for millions and billions of people across the world. Some of the other elements that showed up as red flags in Mark Anderson's work was the section of the manifesto. Just a quick second, whenever you declare something as a manifesto, that in and of itself is a bit of a red flag, because it's a cause for, you know, just to maybe look at the document from a particular point of view, to go through it with a fine-tooth comb. A manifesto can be seen as like an operating manual, like, this is what we're working with, these are stated assumptions, and sometimes getting that down on paper is fine. It gives you a target that you can refer back to. But when we see a manifesto, we also want to look at what's contained within with a greater degree of incredulity to dig a little deeper on what's there. So in the manifesto, there's a section of beliefs that Mark Anderson goes through, each sentence starts with, we believe that, dot, dot, dot. And beliefs are fine. There's nothing wrong with having beliefs. It's when we have beliefs that are contrary to evidence that it can become a problem. And in the belief section, you see a lot of these statements where the belief is contrary to evidence. One of the things he says they believe in is that energy should be too cheap to meter, and that if you have widespread access to energy that's too cheap to meter, then that can be a net societal good. And by large, I agree. Now, the method they cite to get there is part of the problem. They say that through nuclear fission, we will be able to achieve energy that's too cheap to meter. And that's part of the problem, because nuclear fission alone will not get us there. Aside from the massive environmental costs of nuclear fission, of the plants that are currently existing, and from here I'm recalling an article that was published on like fizz.org in 2011, and I still remember some of the extent, so basically I'll paraphrase here. It was saying at the time, 2011, there was 440 existing nuclear fission reactors that supplied, you know, a portion of the world's energy. And to supply the full energy demand through nothing but nuclear fission, we would need 15,000 additional nuclear reactors with all the associated costs, fissile material, environmental costs, and they'd still be putting out, you know, the heat, the steam that's released from nuclear reactors. So there'd be a massive environmental cost from transitioning to that source that would require building like 10 reactors a day, every day for like half a decade to get us close to those numbers for replacement. There's no way for us as society to build up that kind of capacity through nuclear fission alone. And Anderson states that that would allow us to provide energy too cheap to meter, that we could move away from an oil and gas economy. So the actual path is more through more passive elements like solar, wind, and alternative energy sources. Nuclear fission will not get us there. And using nuclear fission to accelerate us into nuclear fusion is also a problem, in that nuclear fusion has also been some mythical target 20 or 30 years down the road, much like AGI, Artificial General Intelligence, and it always seems to be off in the future. We're never quite getting to that point. So citing that as a goal is necessarily a bit of a problem. We're barely getting started here, and we're already three flags in. Now, the next one is that in this area, they also identify as apex predators. Earlier on, he draws a comparison to sharks in nature, move or die, and that ties into this apex predator bit later on. He says that they are predators, they are able to make the lightning work for us. It moves directly from their return to the great man theory, lionizing the technologists and industrialists who came before. Really? Do tell. Whenever you're self-identifying as a predator, that's just like a massive red flag, a warning sign. And I want to be clear, there are aspirational elements in this section, in the We Believe That section. It's just that these aspirational elements are like flowers in a garden filled with these bright red flags. I can get behind the aspirational elements, but even some of those have a massive disconnect with reality. They see the Earth as having like a carrying capacity of like 50 billion humans, and we can barely manage with the 8 billion that we currently have, which is massively overusing the resources available to the tune of like requiring 3 Earths worth of current consumption rates. And while there may be the ability to support 50 billion humans, that would require a massive change in organization and resource usage and result in horrible inequalities across massive numbers of those 50 billion people, with a very select few having anything close to living standards that we have now or that are seen across much of the OECD nations, let alone the globe as a whole. We also see a number of other aspirational elements, other flowers in the garden, in quotes from like Richard Feynman and Buckminster Fuller and others, with odes to the transformative power of science to enlighten us and provide answers to the mysteries of the world around us. But this also comes hand-in-hand with the delegitimizing of expertise, using the Feynman quote to propose a return to the actual, quote-unquote, scientific method, using actual, quote-unquote, information. Whenever we start seeing echoes of the no true Scotsman fallacy in a text, making distinctions about what counts, once again, red flag. Actual information? Like, who decides? Isn't that what science is all about in the first place? And from there, Anderson leans heavily into accelerationism. And again, this is a massive flag for me personally. Whenever someone self-identifies as an accelerationist, I start to seriously question everything they're talking about. Accelerationism is basically the belief that what capitalism really needs is for the gas to be put all the way down to the floor, to press the pedal all the way down so that we can actually hit escape velocity, quote-unquote, and move quicker along the curve towards the singularity or whatever. If you consider technological development as a curve, as a growth curve, then the only way to get higher up it is to go faster. Now, if you look at Geoffrey Moore's work on innovation in Crossing the Chasm, which is an adaptation of Rogers' work on the diffusion of innovations, of the innovation adoption curve, there's a point where any new technology will succeed or fail, based on the point low down on the slope. If I do a video version of this, we'll put this on the screen. Basically, at the low end of the slope, there's this little thing which Moore calls the chasm, and that chasm is where you have the innovators and early adopters. They've kind of picked up on the new tech, and you're trying to take that product, that technological tool or artifact, out to the larger market to get widespread adoption and then see if it flies. Basically, we've seen it with things like virtual reality or DVDs or home video recording, smartphones, whatever. There's a point where the product might be under development for a while, and then the larger population says, okay, we can use this, and they adopt it, and then it sees widespread distribution. Accelerationism views that gap as a challenge, and views tech more generally, and that, like we said, things like capitalism just really needs more gas, more fuel. Problem with that is, obviously, you can't necessarily tell even what's going to take off, what tech is going to get adopted. You can't necessarily make fetch happen, even if you're a billionaire. And there's a lot of problems when you start going that fast with no brakes. If the road starts to swerve ahead of you, you might not be able to change direction in time. And this is where the other side of acceleration comes in. Accelerationism comes in. You see, accelerationism isn't necessarily about something that's either left or right. There are accelerationists on both sides of the political spectrum. There's accelerationists on the right that are pro-capitalist, pro-tech, the version seen here. There are other accelerationists on the right, and you can go check out the Wikipedia page to see what other groups are associated with it. There's also accelerationists on the left who view that capitalism is inherently unstable and want to see it go faster because that will expose the inequities in the system and help it go off the rails so that something better can be rebuilt. You see this in the works of like Slavoj Žižek and other academics on the left, though Žižek himself is kind of mid, I guess. But you'll see that amongst those who are critics of capitalism, who also want it to go faster. There's a problem with both these perspectives. And that problem is basically, and this is the problem I have with it, is that acceleration is that it is a perspective of a tiny elite minority, and it would result in massive amounts of pain for millions and billions of people, while that acceleration is resolving itself, whether going faster or crashing. While things are going faster, more fuel is getting added to the system. You know, the climatic change that we are seeing because of more fuel literally being added to the system. Just the disruption that we can see happening around would cause starvation, job loss, untold pain and suffering. If the current systems we have are disrupted, this is also a problem. You'd have similar effects. And so from my perspective of doing the least pain, of not wanting to see humanity as a whole suffer, then accelerationism is necessarily a bad thing. Let's find a different way. And this is about the point where the Techno-Optimist Manifesto goes into a list of enemies as well. And while that may or may not be typical for a manifesto, I think whenever you're writing something and you have an enemies list, you know, that's a warning flag, a red flag in and of itself. Now, amongst the enemies for the technological optimist are things like sustainability, sustainable development, social responsibility, trust and safety, tech ethics, degrowth, and others. Besides, and when you start to look about who your enemies are, what you're against, that you start wondering what you're really for, right? So the concern here is that any kind of regulation or responsible governance is seen as an enemy, as something to be combated, to be avoided, to be dealt with. And aside from that being a massive red flag, it reveals some of the underlying ethos as well. This is what they're against. They're against regulation, things that were put in place for safety, for ethical use, for managed, for sustainability, for our continued existence on the planet. And these are the things they're against. And I think that is, again, a massive warning sign. And from there, we get to the last red flag that comes up. It's a quote kind of close to the end. It's uncited, unattributed. We don't see the conviction to actually state who this quote is from, because that might make it actually too obvious. The quote is as follows. Beauty exists only in struggle. There is no masterpiece that has not an aggressive character. Technology must be a violent assault on the forces of the unknown to force them to bow before man. End quote. That quote is from Filippo Marinetti from 1909, from the Futurist Manifesto, which he wrote. If you're not familiar with Marinetti, here's the lowdown, and it'll highlight the problem. Like I said, it was unsighted. But if you know who Marinetti is in the story, that's like the biggest warning flag in the entire document, of this entire list of the warning flags that we've already seen. Marinetti, of course, is the founder of the Futurist School in Italy, and wrote the Futurist Manifesto in 1909. Here's some of the elements of futurism. Technology, growth, industry, modernization. Okay, but there's also these other elements. Speed, violence, destruction of museums. War as a necessity for purification. Okay, now, Marinetti would go on to get into politics in Italy a few years later, and work with another group of Italians on another manifesto in 1919. That, of course, was the Fascist Manifesto, which he co-authored. So there's a direct lineage from Marinetti's work and the elements of it that appear in that later manifesto and the works that adopt that as well. If we take all these things, all these red flags together, a list of neoliberal economists, denialism and beliefs contrary to facts, while downplaying education, self-identifying as predators, accelerationism, lists of enemies, and citing proto-fascist literature, all of this combined is a massive red flag. And it's why I'm not a techno-optimist. So, that being said, how would I identify? And that's a fantastic question, because judging on the words alone, techno-optimist is pretty close to where I am. I believe that technology can be used as an assistive tool, as we've stated earlier, and it can help people out, and is generally an extension of man that we can use it for adding to our capabilities. So I might be a techno-optimist, or at least I was until October 16th. Other terms I've seen floating around that I could self-identify with includes things like techno-revivalist, which is close but not quite. That feels like it ties more into, like, experimental archaeology, where we try and recreate the past, use methods of the past in the modern era to figure out what they were doing. It's a fascinating field. We should talk about it sometime. But that isn't really where I am. Solarpunk isn't quite where I'm at either, or cyberpunk either, really. I don't think I really fit within any of the punk genres. I'm pretty straight-laced. I'm a basic B, to be honest. But taking the opposite stance doesn't work either. I'm not a techno-pessimist. I'm generally hopeful for the opportunities that the new technologies can bring. I think that's part of the challenge, is that there isn't a good line for where I sit, aside from what is now defined as a techno-optimist, and I don't think it can be reclaimed. I went through with the number of red flags there. The well is really well and truly poisoned. And with the breadth of reach that particular manifesto got, and the reporting that it saw in multiple areas, I don't think that it would ever come back, even though, much like Michael Bolton in Office Space, why should I change if they're the ones that suck, right? So I think techno-optimist as a term is where it is. It will not change. But I am almost anything but that. And why? Well, part of that is just exposure and upbringing. As I said, I had a significantly different path, one that doesn't lead through Silicon Valley, one that's not even in the same solar system as a billionaire. When you have to go about the business of daily life, when you're almost maybe middle class at best, you're going to have a very different view of technology and its uses and how it can be used for exploitation as well. And I think that comes through in some of our work. So to tie this back to the beginning, to close the loop on why we had to triangulate with examples before we could assay the manifesto, If exposure and experience are what lead one to be able to make quick judgments about a particular work and see where the references are coming from, they can also allow one to see some of the harms that might come about from exposure to those statements as well. And that's really what we're trying to do, to bring some of those associations to light through this particular podcast episode. So as I still search for a term, whether it's retro tech enthusiast or just tech enthusiast or perhaps or media historian, media archaeologist, whatever, I'll keep working on it and once we figure it out. And the figuring it out is what I think is going to be the journey of this podcast as a whole. Once we figure it out, I'll let you know. But if you have any great suggestions in the meantime, reach out and let me know at drimplausible@implausipod.com or at theimplausa.blog. I'll see you around. Take care. This work is, as always, released under a Creative Commons 4.0 share-alike license. Music by me, editing by me, text by me, everything else. Transcript should be up on the blog and along with the episode. And we'll talk to you soon.